Back again to BadQuaker.com podcast. My name is Ben Stone. Today is Monday, July 16th, 2012, and this is podcast number 169. I want to go over a couple things before I get into the meat and potatoes of today's podcast. It was a very busy weekend. We had a lot of stuff going on in the Liberty Movement, people running here and there doing this and that. One of the things that that happened over the weekend, Eddie Free, I've had him on the show. He's a well-known liberty activist. He's been involved in a lot of things. If you recall the big Washington, D.C. Jefferson Memorial dance, where they had a dance party at the Jefferson Memorial in open, how would you put it, open violation or open, you know, anyway, openly breaking the rules about not dancing at the Jefferson Memorial, which was kind of odd to have that rule anyway. But Eddie was the one who organized that and pulled that off. And then quite a few other things as well. And Eddie over the weekend had a sort of a dance party planned on the boardwalk of a town in New Jersey where there was some fuss about it. I'll put a link to the story on badquaker.com where this podcast is, and you can read the story from last week, and I'll try to put two links, one from last week and one with the updated version. Essentially, some you know, minor local stuffed shirt who is involved in politics there decided that she would be offended if she was in a bar and somebody came in a bathing suit, so she wanted to begin enforcing an old law that had been on the books for a long, long time, and try to punish anyone who got up on the boardwalk or went into a local bar or whatever still in their bathing suit. She wanted to, you know, her Puritan nonsense that she wanted to live other people's lives for them, and you know, the very fact that somebody might walk into a bar in a bathing suit would offend her, and she would want to use the force of government to stop that. So Eddie heard about this and organized a smart protest. He actually got a hold of the city there and was doing this in a really smart way. And before, I believe Friday, before the protest even took place, the city council dumped that rule, that law, or that ordinance, or whatever it was. I think it was just an ordinance. Anyway, the city dumped that. So, but the party was already planned, and the protest was already planned. So Eddie and all the people came out, and it was very successful in many ways. Among those that showed up was Adam Kokesh from Adam versus the Man. Now, some people, I had made some statements in a variety of locations publicly calling out Adam Kokesh, saying essentially, you know, are you going to try to take credit for this like you did with the dance party in D.C., or are you going to give credit where credit is due and acknowledge Eddie? And I wasn't the only one doing that. There was a variety of people in the Liberty Movement who were calling out Adam, saying this to him in different places and different spots on the internet. And Adam did the right thing. When he very first started his little video on what was going on there, Adam stepped up and gave Eddie full credit for what happened in Washington, D.C. And that's not the first time that he's acknowledged Eddie on the D.C. thing. He has acknowledged him before, but oftentimes he doesn't. Oftentimes Adam goes out in public and talks about the D.C. thing like if he did it, like if he made it up. And even in the thing there in New Jersey with the bathing suit dance party, Adam gave Eddie full credit for it and yet kind of put a disclaimer on it like, oh yeah, I was going to think that up, but Eddie thought of it first or whatever. But whatever. You know, it was Adam did the right thing, and I've tried to acknowledge that Adam did the right thing, and I'm glad that Adam chose to do that and not try to steal the thunder. Now, some people were a little confused the way that I called out Adam and some of the words that I used. I didn't use any bad words or anything. I just kind of threw it in Adam's face in several locations saying, you know, man up. Are you going to do this? Are you going to do it right? Or are we going to, you know, we're watching you. I said things like that. Are you going to behave like a man? Are you going to try to, you know, and these were challenges that I threw at Adam specifically. And some people have asked me, you know, why are you taking on Adam like that? Well, you know, there are quite a few of us in the Liberty Movement that have been watching Adam from a distance. And for some time, we've not been happy with Adam's progress towards understanding more about the Liberty Movement. Adam started out fairly conservative and a little bit libertarian, and he's made tremendous progress in becoming more and more consistent in what he believes and what he says. But Adam's not there yet. I mean, you know, if I wanted to be a jerk about this, I could take Adam's videos on YouTube, take them apart, and really show some of the really messed up things Adam has done and said. But that's not my point, and I really don't see the value in doing that, so I'm not going to. But I will say that Adam has a long way to go, and some of his tendencies, he really needs to mature a bit, and a little self-examination. And like I said on Facebook, when I use those same words, all of us, every single one of us needs to mature more, and, you know, self-evaluation is an ongoing process. You should always, here's the thing, I've said this before, if you go into the biblical story of the rituals that the priests went through before going into the Holy of Holies in the tabernacle, there was a series of rituals that they would go through. And you know, if you're an atheist listening, or if you're a non-theist, or if you're whatever, this is not a Bible lesson, so, you know, don't get offended or whatever. You can hear these words and not have to hold your ears. This is not going to try, you know, this is not going to instantly convert you to Judaism or something like that, or Christianity or something. So relax and just hear my point. Anyway, in the process that the priests had to go through, they had this special area where they would slaughter the bull or slaughter the whatever the animal was that was being sacrificed. And in this process, and then they would burn the sacrifice, or actually they would cook it and consume it. But in this process, they would get bloody. They would get blood all over them from killing and sacrificing the animal. And they couldn't go into the tent, the tabernacle. They couldn't go into the tent with the blood on their hands of the slaughter. So before they could, between the point of where they made the slaughter and burned the sacrifice to the point of going into the tabernacle, they had to first wash. And there was this big like a big giant bowl full of water. And the bottom of that bowl was polished. The surface of the bottom of that bowl was polished to the point of where when the priest walked up and looked over into the bowl, he could see his own reflection in the polished brass. And so he could wash his hands and wash his beard and wash his face, and he could look at himself as he was washing and see if he missed a spot. And this is important, that it's an important lesson that's there for us to see that before we can do the Lord's work, so to speak, which in this case, for any atheists or whatever listening, I suppose this could be offensive to Jews or Christians that are listening, because they're saying, like, how dare you compare the holy events with whatever. No, but just chill out a little bit and listen to this. Before you can do the Lord's work, whatever that is, whatever the thing that's important for you, whatever you think has to be done, before you can confront somebody, before you can do anything, that's important like that, self-examination is critical, because it's really important to be able to, you know, the other phrase that actually comes from the Bible is to remove the beam in your eye before you try to remove the splinter in somebody else's eye. And that's really important to us. So what I'm saying to Adam, you know, you need some self-examination. Well, we all need self-examination. We need self-examination daily. And as we do that, and I try to do that as much as possible, but all of us need to do that. And all of us need to constantly refine what we believe and constantly compare what we believe with the zero aggression principle and property rights and understanding of liberty. I talk about that stuff all the time because that's really the whole focus of this podcast and the whole focus of the website is the zero aggression principle, property rights, and liberty. So that's why I said that to Adam. It's critically important for all of us on all levels to constantly re-examine our message, re-examine what we're saying. Ask ourselves, am I staying on point? Am I wandering? You know, Adam, you really don't have to talk about how fat cops are, because that really has nothing to do with liberty. It really doesn't help our message in any way. Yelling at people through a bullhorn, I'm not sure that helps. I'm really not. I think maybe all you're doing is making a fool of yourself and irritating people. I really think that, you know, a more principled, a more calm approach. Yeah, you know, you won't get all the fun, all the excitement, all the cheers and you know, all that stuff. Yeah, but do we really need all that? And the kind of people that brings into the movement, is that bringing in a positive element or a negative element? And so, you know, to self-examine and to look at what it is that we're doing and say, is this moving us in a positive direction? Is this helping? Is this hurting? These things are really important to us. So I wasn't taking on Adam, you know, out of meanness. I was defending Eddie Free to a certain extent because Adam's trampled on him on a few occasions. But mostly, you know, Adam has a very large audience. And with that large audience comes a large responsibility. And it's important to make sure that you're on message and that you're not being distracted by all the noise and all the fans and all the hoopla. Some other people on the internet might notice that I regularly take a shot at Jack Hunter, the so-called Southern Avenger. And there's a reason for that, too. You know, Jack Hunter, I really enjoy listening to Jack Hunter. He's fun to listen to and so forth. And he's almost right. But the things that he's wrong on are so important that, you know, if you compare it to, say, shooting down a rifle range at a target, rather than shooting towards the target, in many ways, Jack Hunter doesn't recognize that there is a target. He's on the rifle range, he's firing away, but, you know, I have to question whether or not he recognizes what the target is, where the target is, or even if there is a target. If you see me slapping him around or attacking him or so forth, it's for the same reason. Jack Hunter actually sort of came to public light to a lot of people with his attack on, was it Mark Levin? I think it was Mark Levin that he viciously attacked, and then there's been sort of a back and forth between the two. And I appreciated that because, you know, Mark Levin needs to be slapped down whenever possible. But, you know, again, I think Jack needs to do a little self-evaluation and really look at himself. I told him one time that he reminded me of Gary Oldman in The Fifth Element, because, you know, there's some really cool things about Gary Oldman's character in The Fifth Element. But if I didn't know better, I would think Gary Oldman actually studied Jack Hunter in order to create that character in The Fifth Element. But there is a great scene in The Fifth Element that's put out. Several people have linked to it in YouTube, just this one scene where the character that Gary Oldman is playing demonstrates his knowledge of economics by knocking a water glass off of his desk, and then all these little robots come out from every direction and they mop up the water and they clean up the glass, and another one puts a new glass on his table and another one fills it, and all these little robots are all running around being busy. And he uses this as an example of economics, and of course it's Keynesian economics. It's the broken window fallacy, the idea that pretty much the way to stimulate the economy is by smashing something, and then everybody gets busy fixing it. And that's the way most mainstream economists believe that nonsense, as do most people in politics. And so, seeing that really reminded me of Jack Hunter, because I've never seen any you know, true Austrian economics coming from Jack Hunter, and I question whether he has any knowledge of them at all, even though he's a rabid Ron Paul supporter. But I would like to question him on that and see what his knowledge is on Austrian economics, and see if he doesn't fall right in line with the very Republicans that he wails against. But that's a side issue. As I say, I like Jack Hunter. I like listening to him. He's fun to listen to. His accent's interesting, and he always reminds me of Gary Oldman in that shot. But I was actually I didn't mean to spend that much time talking about that stuff from the weekend, and specifically, I didn't mean to spend that much time talking about Jack Hunter or Adam Kokesh. I meant to start off by talking about what Kai and I talked about on the last podcast. Oh, you know, I should say this first. I had a really busy weekend, and I was really over my head in a lot of ways, and I had a busy last part of last week as well. And so I haven't been keeping up with my email. If you've sent me email and I haven't responded to you, please be patient. I'll get to it as soon as I can. I'm trying to get caught up. I really kind of got overwhelmed in the last week or so. And if you want to email me, it's Ben, B-E-N, at badquaker.com. And be sure and spell bad Quaker and not bad quacker, as some have made the mistake. Anyway, so if you've emailed me and I haven't got back to you, I apologize. I'm trying to get caught up on that as quickly as possible. I did see one correction, and I don't know if this was email or if this was on Facebook, about the discussion with Kai about Excedrin migraine. And the person pointed out that Excedrin migraine is, chemically speaking, is identical in its content to regular Excedrin, and that may have had something to do with them taking Excedrin migraine off the market. Really it was just a marketing ploy that regular Excedrin had the same chemicals, the same makeup. It's the same product, basically, just labeled differently. You know, when Kai and I were talking about that last week, actually that was just the introduction to my notes for the podcast last Friday. So I'm going to break for a commercial here, and when I come back from the commercial, I'm going to pick up on my notes that I would have used for last Friday. So I'm going to go over some of this stuff about over-the-counter medicines that you've heard already, but I'm going to go into why I was going to talk about that. And so as soon as I get back from the commercial break, we'll get into that. Hold on, I'll be right back. Folks, have you seen the silver and gold trading cards from Shire Silver? You have to check these out. They're specific weights of real silver or gold laminated inside trading cards, and they're a great way to show the world a better way to save, spend, and share precious metals. And now you can buy them using bitcoins or Federal Reserve notes. Folks, you really need to check this out. Go over to Shire Silver, watch the video on the main page, check out the list of merchants that accept silver and gold trading cards, and you can even learn how you can get paid to help spread the word about Shire Silver trading cards. Okay, thanks for sticking with me through the commercial. What I was talking about last week, or what I brought up when Kai was with me on the podcast, was the number of over-the-counter medications that are either disappearing or becoming very difficult to get a hold of. And there's a variety of reasons that they're giving us for taking these things off the market, or making them harder to get, or so forth. There's things like we're told that, well, we can't just, you know, have cold medications out where anybody can buy them, because somebody might turn them into meth. And of course, that's I've gone on before about how the government cracking down on the marijuana trade pushed people into the cocaine trade. The government's crackdown on the cocaine trade forced people, not just the dealers, but the buyers as well, into using the more aggressive types of cocaine, like rock or crack, as they called it back east. But as the government started then cracking down on crack cocaine, cracking down on crack, then that pushed people towards heavier drugs, cheaper, to produce, less quality, and produced locally rather than having to bring it in from Central America. So that meant meth. So meth could be produced very quickly in somebody's kitchen or in the bathroom of a, you know, of a motel or whatever, in the back of a van or whatever. So this created a market for a product that could be created, that could be made on a mom and pop level, pretty much anywhere with a very a simple understanding of chemicals. And so that created the meth problem. And then the crackdown on the mom and pop production of meth, the violent, aggressive crackdown on the mom and pop production of meth in the U.S. had yet another negative consequence, and that was it pushed the meth production out of the hands of the mom and pop people in the U.S. and literally pushed it into the hands of the big drug cartels in Central America. So, you know, in a sense, the government's war on drugs outsourced the production of meth right into the hands of some of the most evil people on the planet. Well, no, those would be in Washington, D.C., but you get my meaning here. And the government's actual focus on the drug war and specifically attacking the meth production drove massive amounts of money into the pockets of gang members and into the pockets of the big drug cartels. So in a very real sense, everything the government has done to fight drugs has made the situation worse. And this is the logical process. If you understand the basics of true economics, this is a guaranteed process. This is what's going to happen. You should fully expect this. So this is one of the reasons we're told why some of these over-the-counter medications are being banned or being made harder to get a hold of or whatever. And there's some classic examples where a totally innocent person goes in and you know, they have a cold or whatever. So they go into a store and they buy some over-the-counter cold medication. And then 2 days later, this woman had a cold. So she went in, or maybe her daughter had a cold. I think it was her daughter that had a cold. So she goes in and she buys the cold medication for her daughter. And then it was like 2 or 3 days later or something, she was on the other side of town visiting her mother, and her mother had a cold. So she went to the local pharmacy or grocery store or whatever that was near her mother's house, and she again bought some more cold medication. And this flagged her because she had bought cold medication in two different stores within a couple days of each other in the same town. This flagged her, and she ended up getting arrested over this and had to fight it in court to prove why it was she was buying so much cold medication. You know, this is stupid. This is ridiculous. But this is the outcome of the government's you know, supposedly good intentions. But if we go back and read Bastiat and we understand that whenever the government takes an action, there is that which is seen and that which is not seen. And almost always, if that which is seen is good, if the short term, if the thing that is obvious that the government action does, if that seems to be good, the odds are something really horrible is happening in the background that you can't detect. And there's no way of knowing exactly how bad it's going to be. That's the principle of that which is seen and that which is not seen. And so when the government does these stupid things, like outlawing cold medications or making them harder to get a hold of, interfering with the market in any way, there are all kinds of repercussions from that that are entirely unpredictable, and some that are predictable, but they're always bad. They're always going to be bad repercussions because the government is acting with aggression. That's the only method that the government has, is aggression. And so, you know, the rule, you two wrongs don't make a right. It doesn't matter how many times you aggress, you can't produce a good product from that. You can't produce a good from acting in an evil way. And that's what every act of the government is. So when they are banning cold medications or whatever, you're just setting up a series of bad events to take place because of it. And another example of that is with over-the-counter medications. Back during the Bush days, and again, anytime that I want to, anytime I mention a politician, whether it's Bush or, you know, Baby Bush or Papa Bush or Bill Clinton or Ronald Reagan or the current thief that's in the White House, whoever that might be at the time, right now it's Barack Obama, but whoever that thief is that's up there at the time, I have the same regard for all of these people. Every single one of them. They're just thugs. They're just thieves. That's all they are. I don't have any preference of, you know, Obama over Bush or Bush over Obama or the, you know, Mitt Romney, that I don't look at him as some kind of savior that might come in and fix things. Of course, if you're a regular listener of that, of this podcast, you probably already realize that. But anyway, so back during the Bush era, Bush decided to interfere in the drug market by having a massive expansion of government influence into the medical industry and into medicine and into the health industry. And what that meant was that massive amounts of government money suddenly became available to purchase over-the-counter drugs with. In addition to that, tax advantages, you could actually get a if you kept track of how much you paid for over-the-counter medications, you could, if you were already filing a long form in your taxes, you could deduct part of what you spent on over-the-counter medications. You could deduct part of that in your taxes. So, and a lot of conservatives said, oh, this is great. We can, the more deductions we have on our taxes, the better. But what you don't understand is it doesn't matter what the intent of the government is, and it doesn't matter what the action is. Anytime the government takes an action, negative consequences take place. Even if it's giving you some of your money back, negative consequences take place because it's a government action, and every single government action is based on aggression. So by Bush doing something that was conservative and doing something what a lot of conservatives thought was right in allowing deductions for over-the-counter medications, and maybe some of that existed even before Bush, I'm not sure exactly because I don't follow IRS laws that closely, but either way, the point is, this interfered in the over-the-counter medication market, and it disturbed and altered the market. There's no way a government action can do good. Anytime there's interference in the market, there's always a bad result of it. So this is what happened in the 2000s under Bush. He, you know, pushed his way into the drug market, interfered with the drug market. And so now it had messed up the drug market so bad and started costing so much to the federal government that by 2010, they had to revise the order and step back on it. I want to read for you something here. This is from a government publication. Over-the-counter medicines or drugs purchased without a prescription on or after January 1st, 2011, other than insulin, may no longer be paid for or reimbursed under Health Flexible Spending Arrangements, FSAs, Health Reimbursement Arrangements, HRAs, Health Savings Accounts, HSAs, or Archer Medical Savings Accounts, Archer MSAs. The IRS recently released Notice 2010-59, which provides further guidance on these changes made by the Affordable Care Act, the ACA. Now, at this point, you know, they really love those using letters, FSAs, HRAs, HSAs, MSAs, an ACA, an IRS, and all these other ridiculous. I wonder what the fascination government has with that. Here's what it reminded me of. Here's a little thing from Robin Williams in the movie Good Morning Vietnam. I'll just play this for you.
Excuse me, sir. Seeing as how the VP is such a VIP, shouldn't we keep the PC on the QT? Because if it leaks to the VC, you can end up an MIA, and then we'd all be put on KP.
Yeah. So what happened there was the government interfered in the over-the-counter medication industry by actually giving breaks for it and actually paying some for it through these different government-sanctioned insurance programs and account savings programs and so forth that the government had set up. And then they realized, you know, this is costing way too much, way more money than they thought it would, and so they back out of it. So by interfering in the government, in the market, they messed up the market. And then by pulling out of the market, the government messed up the market. And that's, to a large degree, their pulling out of the market in January of 2011 is what prompted a lot of these companies to either stop producing medications, over-the-counter medications, or alter them, or slow down production, or make them harder to get, you know, whatever. Even the act of cutting government interference caused government interference. That's because, again, there is no action that the government can take that's not based on aggression. So the other thing that we're told about all this is that some of these were bad for the environment. That was the excuse given for Primatene Mist. Primatene is the inhaler that's used by so many asthma patients. We're told that Primatene Mist was hard on the environment, and therefore we have to eliminate it because those tiny little cans were somehow hurting the environment. Let's not worry about aircraft carriers floating across the continent. Across the oceans. Let's not worry about jet planes flying from coast to coast. How much fuel does a jet plane burn when it carries people from coast to coast? Let's not worry about that. Let's not think about just how much fuel is burned by tanks, by government tanks alone, just in practice maneuvers. Let's not worry about that. Let's worry about somebody using a Primatene Mist inhaler when they're having an asthma attack. Unbelievable. So this is the excuses they use. Reduce the cost of healthcare. To reduce the cost of healthcare, that's what this law that changed in January of 2011, to reduce the cost of healthcare, you're going to create a situation that's going to mess with the market and force people to have to go to the doctor to get a prescription for something rather than be able to get it over the counter. And why? Because you want to reduce the cost of healthcare. Unbelievable. So the government invades and distorts the market. Then they build dependencies upon that. So there were people that for years were keeping track of their their over-the-counter medication purchases so they could deduct them from their taxes. So you build a dependency on these things, and then you yank out, then you interfere with the market again. You yank the government's approval for these things, or you yank the government's funding of them, and then people are stuck. So what are they going to do? They're going to end up going to the doctor and paying more than they would have paid to begin with, and maybe not even getting as safe a product because the doctor's going to tend to prescribe whatever he gets kickbacks on for the most of his prescriptions. Of course, not all doctors do that, but a good portion do. So who do we blame for this? Who's our enemy? Who can we point to? Can we just say, well, follow the money? You know, follow the money. It must be the big pharma. That's who the monster is. It must be the big pharma. Is it the AMA? Maybe it's the AMA. The big pharmaceutical companies are not enough. They're in it with the AMA. It's all, it's a conspiracy. That's what it is. Maybe it's the insurance companies, the evil insurance companies. Or maybe it's a super evil genius that pulls all the strings in so many aspects of life, from the lemonade stand laws to the Amish drinking, or selling raw milk to GasX. It's all a manipulation from these evil, this evil family living in a French chateau somewhere and scheming the end of the world to their benefit or something. Well, you can take your mind in all those directions, but the fact is, the root of the problem comes back to the state. It comes back to this imaginary concept that some people can be given authority and can act with authority over other people, and that somehow that can produce good. That is the myth of the state. And it's the myth of the state that makes a place for people in government to take these actions, thinking honestly that they're doing good, that they're improving. Yeah, there's bribes taken, and a lot of times politicians are not acting in the best benefit, in what they believe to be the best benefit of people. But really and truly, that's not where the problem lies. The problem lies in this silly idea that some people can govern and other people should obey that, and that this will somehow produce a good thing. That's where the real problem lies. It's not really the progressives. Progressives hate they tend to. Progressives tend to hate self-medication on any level. That's why they hated the alcohol that's why they love the alcohol prohibition so much. It's why the war on drugs is as powerful as it is. All the way to the point of reaching for your asthma inhaler. The progressives want to stop you from doing that. They want you to ask permission and be dependent upon your masters for everything. But the problem is not just the progressives. We know for a fact that prohibitions never work. So if it was just the problem with the progressives, then all we have to do is let the thing work itself out. And, black markets will fix the problem with prohibition, and eventually the problem will be solved. But it's not just the progressives, and it's not just the Republicans or the conservatives or the far right wing or the neocons or the religious right. None of these people are the real problem. The problem goes back to this thought, this belief that any acceptance at all of the idea that some people can lord themselves over other people and make laws and inflict those laws upon other people. That's the real root of this problem. I'm going to break now for our next commercial break. It's very short. Stick with me. I'll be right back. When I come back, I'm going to read something from Butler Schaefer that he wrote that I thought was really good. And so stick with me. I'll be right back, and we'll talk about Butler Schaefer. Folks, I want to talk to you about survival gear bags. Survival Gear Bags is about more than just great gear bags and survival kits. Check out their website by clicking the banner at badquaker.com. Survival Gear Bags has everything from Wise food storage products to tactical equipment to camping supplies to clothing and rain gear to hydration and purification systems to books and DVDs. Plus, Survival Gear Bags is known for its service, and it's owned and operated by people who understand and adhere to the zero aggression principle. So get over to Survival Gear Bags and get the stuff you need. Okay, and thanks for sticking with me through the commercial. This appeared over at lewrockwell.com in an article by Butler Schaefer, and I'll try to remember to put a link to it in the show notes for today at badquaker.com. I'm going to read just this little paragraph out of the article, but the article is worth reading. It's a good article, and it's not that long, but anyway, I want to read this part. I have long been of the view that trying to reform the political system or running for political office is counterproductive. I continue to hold this view, even as I greatly admire what Ron Paul has been able to accomplish within the political system. His accomplishments, however, are to be found in helping to raise the conscious awareness of millions of people to see the state for the vicious racket that it is. It must also be noted that Ron is a very exceptional case. He understands the problems of statism and understands the problems of statism with an intellectual depth few others share. Those who cling to faith in the electoral politics should be forewarned to pay little attention to the make-believe libertarians, and he puts that in quotes, libertarians, who brandy about phrases they neither understand nor embrace. There is an important distinction to be drawn between making compromises as to strategy, i.e., how best to advance peace and liberty, and principles. One must learn how to distinguish the two, as there will be many eager for political power who will sound like principled libertarians as they help advance statism. And then he puts in parentheses, does the name Ronald Reagan ring a bell? And again, that's by Butler Schaefer, and the whole article can be found at lewrockwell.com. You can get a link to it on the page where this podcast appears on badquaker.com. Now, the reason I wanted to read that, there's actually two reasons, because to a certain extent it falls back on what I was talking about at the beginning of the podcast when I was sort of slamming Adam Kokesh and Jack Hunter. It's easy to learn the buzzwords. It's easy to learn the right phrases and spit them out at the right time. Ronald Reagan was had a real talent for that. Ronald Reagan, if you just went by what he said, you would have thought that he was more of a libertarian than Harry Brown, almost. But if you look at his deeds, then we have a whole different monster altogether. And that's really what Butler Shaver is talking about here. You have to look beyond the catchphrases and the magic words and the, you know, all those neat things that certain people will say in order to sound like they're one of us, when in fact they are not one of us. They are simply here to advance the state and advance themselves. And so that's what I was taking a shot there. I hope Adam Kokesh, I think Adam does understand to a certain extent, but like I was saying before, he has a distance to go still, and I hope, and I think he probably will continue to progress in the right direction. I hope so, anyway. Jack Hunter, I'm not so sure about. You know, I think Jack is real comfortable in his conservatism, and I don't think he's going to change or learn. But I'm going to keep poking him. As long as he keeps allowing me, I'm going to keep poking him. So maybe one day he might actually, you know, he might see, like, for instance, he likes to use the phrase principled conservative values or principled conservative. And every time I see him do that, I throw a question at him. What exactly is a principled conservative? Is that like a unicorn? Is that like some other mythical beast that people might believe in, but there's no actual evidence it exists? What is a principled conservative? Because, you know, what I'd like for Jack to do is tell me what conservative principles are. Now, he can probably come up with a few phrases and a few words, but the fact is, conservatism is not based on principles. Conservatism, like liberalism, is based on wants. That's it. They want the government to do A, B, and C. They don't want the government to do this A, B, and C. That's the only difference between liberals and conservatives, is their list of things they want to use the government to do and the list of things they don't want the government to do. That's the only difference between liberals and conservatives. That's not principles. That's, you know, when a baby's screaming, or I shouldn't say a baby, I should say a little child, that's a spoiled little child that's always had its way and has never actually taught anything valuable. When that child is crying for candy and throwing a fit, it's not because the child is principled. It's because the child wants something and demands you give it to them. Well, that's exactly what liberals and conservatives do. They want the state to be their big nanny and hand them the things that they want, and not the things that they don't want. The only difference between the liberal and the conservative is that they want different things. Well, that's not principled. Libertarianism is principled. We're actually founded on a principle, the zero aggression principle. And if you follow through with that, there are logical results that will always turn in a positive direction. But without a principle, if you just have wants, then, you know, you're no different than that spoiled little baby. And that's what most liberals and conservatives are. They're just spoiled little babies, little children, just wanting the government to do this, wanting the government to do that, wanting the government to punish those people, wanting the government to arrest those people. That's all they are. This takes me to a different thing. One of the listeners pointed me towards a video where a guy's talking about this Army Chief of Staff who has said some horrific things lately, and the video basically says that this Army Chief of Staff is an enemy of America, and if you have sworn your allegiance to the Constitution, if you have taken the oath of office, or if you have taken the oath in the U.S. military to protect and defend the Constitution, well, the Army Chief of Staff is a threat to the Constitution. And I would agree with that. Of course, as you know, if you're a longtime listener, I don't swear an oath to anything, period. And I think the Constitution is not only worthless, but I think it's actually a negative value, because it gives people a false hope that the government can be controlled, or that somehow the state can produce good. And in that sense, the Constitution is dangerous and bad, because it's part of the process of fooling people into believing that you can, you know, that you can hold a dragon by the tail and not get burned. So in that sense, you know, the guy is pointing out that the Army Chief of Staff is an enemy to America. Yeah, but in the same process, you're to use the Constitution as the reason. Well, you know, good luck with that. But the real point of what I wanted to get to, I don't have time today to go into a deal on the video because it was actually a pretty good video. He just missed some points on things. But I wanted to go into something called identification friend or foe. And I think it's important because it's kind of what Butler Schaefer was talking about and what I just read there. And it's kind of what I was talking about with Adam Kokesh and Jack Hunter. The ability to identify who is our friend and who is not our friend. I think, let me be specific so that no one's confused. I think Adam Kokesh is our friend. I think he's confused. I think he needs to mature and do some self-evaluation, like I said. But I think he's our friend. Jack Hunter, I don't think so. I don't think he's our friend. Now, let me get to this identification friend or foe, or IFF, as it's called. First off, this existed in an older form going back into antiquity. You would have someone standing guard, and as someone approached, they would be, you know, ready for combat, and they would, and the person guarding would be ready for combat. And if someone approached the camp, then a shout would be given out, you know, identify yourself, or speak and be recognized, or something like this. Halt, friend or foe, that kind of a thing. And there would be a challenge, like, who are you? Why are you here? Who sent you? Let me see your papers, whatever. And then the incoming person would then have to respond to that challenge. And they would say the secret password, or they would say, I'm with so-and-so division, or I speak on behalf of so-and-so, or here's my letter from so-and-so to show why I'm here, or here's my white flag, I've come to negotiate, or whatever. But there would be a challenge, and then they were from the person on guard, and then there would be a respond to that challenge by the person approaching. So that's how IFF worked prior to the modern age. Now, in Germany, back in the first part of World War II, and actually just before World War II, identification friend or foe, IFF, like the letters that we were making, that I was making fun of earlier. Anyway, so Germany, back to the story. So Germany developed this radar that would send out a signal that would challenge. And an aircraft would have a special machine, a radar machine, on board the aircraft, and it would send a response to that message. And these were coded messages and predetermined ahead of time and on different frequencies, and they would be a different code. And the on-ground sender of the message and the aircraft, the machine and the aircraft, could be preset to different settings so that an order would be given for a particular day, and all the aircraft that were out that day would be set to a specific setting, and the ground radar machine would be set to a specific setting so that you could change the settings according to the orders and make sure that everybody was up to date. And that way you could identify airplanes from the ground as to whether they were incoming friendlies or incoming foes. So the Germans developed this. The problem is, almost immediately the British broke the code. So all the British had to do was either jam the signal or fake the signal. So by the British knowing the code, the Germans were actually worse off using the IFF rather than not using it at all and just relying on guys with binoculars. So and this was the case also to a certain extent with the breaking of the Japanese code in the Pacific by the U.S. The U.S. government had broke the Japanese code. But the Japanese didn't know this. So the American government was listening to secret Japanese discussions and knew well in advance that Pearl Harbor was going to be attacked and so forth. And this gave the Japanese a false sense of security that really didn't exist. They were not as secure as they thought. This is why the carriers were not at Pearl Harbor at the time of the attack, by the way. All the important ships to modern warfare were out of the harbor, and only the old relics were in the harbor. I'm not doing a big thing on Pearl Harbor today, but I'm just throwing that out. The point is that if your enemy has broken your code, then your code is worse than not usable. It's actually deadly because you still trust in it. And our system has been, as libertarians and as anarchists and so forth, our system has been compromised. Our codes have been broken. if we're talking to someone and they say, let's put it this way. Let's say you're talking to someone and you say, well, what about the Federal Reserve? And they say, yeah, we need to audit that Federal Reserve or else we need to just kill it altogether. Well, then automatically you think, oh, he's one of us. He's one of us. But not necessarily. This can be a false positive. This can be a socialist walking into the, you know, into the liberty camp, so to speak. This can be a guy who has broken the code and knows the secret, you know, the secret handshake or whatever, and can get in past our guards just because they understand that you're supposed to audit the Federal Reserve or kill the Federal Reserve. And I would argue, I'll just throw in a disclaimer, I would argue if there was a free market, we wouldn't have to kill the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve would be self-destructive. My argument in this is that it would be wrong to use the government to destroy the Federal Reserve, because you're using the government to destroy a private corporation. That would be the same as using the government to destroy Walmart. You shouldn't try to use the government to destroy the Federal Reserve. What you should do is get rid of the government, get rid of the aggression of the state, and there would be no Federal Reserve. The market would figure out what needed to be there, and the market would supply it. There's no reason to audit the Federal Reserve. They're all crooks. We know this. And there's no reason to kill the Federal Reserve. Again, the market would take care of this you're fighting the wrong enemy if you're fighting the Federal Reserve. You're fighting you're striking at a branch rather than striking at the root. But my point in this, again, is that there are these key words that produce false positives, that people, the greenbackers will, socialists, greenbackers will come into the camp using these keywords like, oh, you have to get rid of the Federal Reserve, and they're no more libertarian than I am a ostrich. If they're not upholding the zero aggression principle, then they're simply not libertarian. It doesn't matter what fancy words that they use, or it doesn't matter that they know all the right key phrases. It doesn't matter, you know, all those things are aside. Most of our key phrases have been compromised and are being used by people on the right or people on the left. This was the problem with Ronald Reagan. He knew all the right key words to use to cause both conservatives and libertarians to say, hey, you know, that guy might be right. He might have something there. But then his actions were opposite of that. So, you know, here's another example. A challenge goes, hey, what about the Constitution? Well, there's no right answer to that, because the Constitution was an act of deception from the start, and it remains the single most dangerous document to freedom simply because people believe in it. So if somebody says, what about the Constitution? And they answer, well, we need to get back to the Constitution. Ink, wrong answer. But the problem is, a lot of libertarians don't realize that. A lot of libertarians are uninformed about the whole purpose of the Constitution being written. So, again, this is producing a false positive in the other direction. And a libertarian says we need to get back to the Constitution, it's because he's confused. It's not because he's the enemy. So, you know, using the identification friend or foe method is very difficult as a libertarian, because you get these false positives like Jack Hunter, and you get false negatives like people who might think that the Constitution is a good thing. So it's very difficult to just use these key words and key phrases as a way to check somebody. It's really more important to look deeply and see what it is that they're doing and what the real message is that they're bringing forth. That's really a chore that all of us have to do, and it's a chore that we have to put on ourselves as well, to constantly ask ourselves, look in that mirror, look in that dish, and like I was talking about with the rituals of the tabernacle, you look at your reflection in that dish, and you say, do I have all the blood off my hands? Have I washed away all aspects of the state in the things that I hold to and the things that I believe? Or do I still have a smudge of the state on my cheek? You know, do I still have the blood of the state on my hands? And you just continue to self-examine until you can wash away all these aspects of statism that have held, that we've held to over the years. So when you hear these phrases, and it doesn't matter, it can be liberty, Freedom, Ron Paul, the Fed, real money, fiat money, credit expansion. There's all these words that and phrases that are tossed around, but they're not as good a test as they could be, or as many of us believe that they should be, because our code's been broken. Our system has been compromised. Our camp has been infiltrated, and there's lots of them in our camp speaking these words that have no idea what the meanings of those words really are. And so we need to really look for the practical outworking. I'm reminded in the last few moments here, I'm reminded about something, and don't take this as evangelism. Just consider the contrast of the two things. Almost all of my family are Baptist. I was raised in a Baptist home. My father was deacon of several Baptist churches. And, I was raised in a strict Baptist home my whole life. And now I'm a Quaker. And one of the stark differences I see between Baptists and Quakers is, with a simple word, testimony. Now, when I was a child and I was in Baptist churches, if someone said, what's your testimony? Well, what that referred to in the Baptist churches that I was raised in, it meant that a person stood up during a meeting, and they either stood, where they sat at the pew or whatever, at their seats or whatever. They would either stand there and speak, or sometimes they would come to the front of the church. If there was a mic, if it was a big assembly or whatever, they would come to the front of the church, either to the podium or to a microphone that was set up on the floor, and they would give what they called their testimony. And they would say something like, well, I sure love the Lord, and the Lord's been good to me, and this has happened, and that's happened, and, I sure was glad that my battery started or on my car when I was this or that or whatever. And they say things that have happened in their lives that they believe is their testimony. And they'll say things like, I'm sure glad that I'm not a sinner, or I'm sure glad that, I don't drink anymore, or I'm sure glad that I don't have a drug addiction anymore, or whatever they would be saying like this. Now, that was the Baptist version of a testimony. It's someone standing up, speaking words. Whereas a Quaker testimony, when you talk to a Quaker about their testimony, so for example, like if someone says to me, Ben, what is your testimony on truth? Okay, well, I can say that I make every effort every day to not lie, but my testimony is not in my words. My testimony is in my life. I can say those words, but if I'm not living that, then I don't have a testimony. So, for example, the Quaker's testimony is peace. Not a big sentence, not a lot of words, not talking about peace, but the Quaker's testimony is peace. And if the Quaker is not peaceful, then he has no testimony. And so, for me personally, I strive towards having a testimony of peace. And I fail a lot because I tend towards violence, and I don't want that. I want to have a testimony of peace, but I can't have a testimony of peace if I'm not peaceful. And this is the vast difference in my experience with Baptists and Quakers. The testimony with the Baptist that I grew up around was words, but the testimony of the Quaker is how you walk your life out, your actual deeds. And that's the measure that we need to do with libertarianism. You can use all the magic words, liberty, freedom, Ron Paul, zero aggression principle. You can throw these things out all you want. But if you aren't striving, none of us are perfect. And that's the thing with being a Quaker. I'm not perfect at all. I'm not where I need to be. But I'm striving towards it. I'm moving towards it. And if we do that with liberty, if we do that with the zero aggression principle, if we do that with property rights, we're moving towards liberty. We're trying to achieve zero aggression principle. We're trying to respect property rights and teach others to respect property rights. This is, we have to judge ourselves and judge others, not on the words, not on the magic words, because that code's been broken. We need to judge ourselves and we need to judge others based on what the real message is, what the real testimony is. What are your feet doing, not what your mouth doing? That's the difference. Not what your lips are doing, but what your hands are doing, what your feet are doing. What are your actions? Are your actions meeting your words? That's the real testimony. Folks, thanks for listening. For more on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, be sure and get over to badquaker.com. Thank you very much, folks.